Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, back to The Other Identity, your favorite podcast about comic books and all things comic. I'm, of course, the great Landis, your stalwart host, and along with me, as always, Ben, a.k.a. Professor Awesome. How's it going, Ben?
It's going great, Robbie. I think there was a lot of extra pep in your step today. That welcome was it was almost Michael Buffer-like. It was very impressive.
I'm not sure who that is.
I know. I was just, the minute I said it, I was like, this reference will be lost on him. He's a boxing announcer. Hopefully most of the people listening know who Michael Buffer is. He's been top boxing players. It throws me back to long ago, last night on Twitter, when, if you guys are following Checkpoint XP on Twitter, the debate about the greatest Zelda game of all time.
Yes.
And where you were playing the role of Elder Statesman, and I kind of butted in and said, I don't think so, sir. That is my spot. Let me jump in here and talk about, as you're talking about your game from the 2000s being old, and I'm like, let's go back to 1988 and talk about the real old school Zelda games.
Wow, yes, indeed. So we have a great show for you today, one that's been in the works for a while. I'm very, very excited for this one, though. Ben, you finally completed the In Blackest Night Challenge.
Yes, I was going to say, it's been a long time coming because I read things so slowly. And Blackest Night, do you remember how many installments there were of Blackest Night?
79. Were there 79 issues?
I think there was something like 79 issues when you factor in all the crossovers. So it took me a little over 2 months to do. I did one issue a day.
Oh, 80! I was one off!
Oh, all right. So it was like 2.5 months. But yeah, man, it was really fun revisiting this. I'm excited to talk about it later in the show.
Yep. So before we do get to the show, though, other than Blackest Night, what have you been reading? Has there been anything that's really stood out to you? Because I know you have a bunch of reading stuff going on. Age of Apocalypse, Modern Marvel. I saw you posting about some Venom stuff the other day.
Venom's the one I wanted to talk about today. So I have been back and forth on Venom in the sense that I've read a few issues of the Donny Cates, Ryan Stegman, current Venom ongoing here and there. And I did read the Absolute Carnage event without the context of Venom. I decided my next little deep dive was I was going to go back and catch up on Venom. And it's been quite... it's funny that we talk about it on the Blackest Night episode because I liken it, and I was having a conversation with a friend of the show, Russell Sellers, about this on my Instagram, at Ben Reads Comics, and I liken what Donny Cates and Ryan Stegman are doing with Venom a lot to what Geoff Johns did with Green Lantern.
Really?
In the sense, yes. Not exactly the same, don't get me wrong. It's very different. There's cosmic elements, but it's not the cosmic book that Green Lantern is. But what reminds me of it is when Geoff took over Green Lantern, one of the things that I thought was great was he didn't try to reinvent the wheel and say, here's all this new stuff that you've never seen before. This is a completely new Hal Jordan. This is a completely new Green Lantern Corps. He introduced elements like the Rainbow Corps and all that stuff, but it was all grounded in stuff that had come before. And that's what I feel like he's really good at.
Does this follow the events that happened in War of the Realms?
War of the Realms, I'm actually at right now. War of the Realms is like in the middle.
Okay, because there was a small part when I read through War of the Realms where like some interesting sort of stuff happened with Venom, but obviously, you know, there's this greater story going on, so it's nothing that they really tried to explain or delve into deeper.
I think what's really cool is that Donny Cates takes Eddie Brock, obviously the most well-known Venom. He takes the symbiote. He takes all this old stuff from the 90s, and like Geoff did with a lot of old, like, goofy Green Lantern villains or Green Lantern concepts, he says, all right, there's a nugget of a good idea here. Let's expand upon it. Mm-hmm. So he takes, like, Eddie's relationship with his father, which was probably like two panels in the 90s, and does a whole issue on it. He creates this whole mythology of the symbiote is not just this one-off alien. There's like a god of the symbiotes, and there have been all these previous symbiotes. It's just like the idea of saying, all right, this is a cool character. I don't need to tear him up completely and build him from the ground up. What I can do is say, this seemed really cool. This villain, this costume, this supporting character seemed really cool, but not enough was done with it because it was the 90s. Mm-hmm. And how can I take a modern storytelling perspective and do something really cool with it? I know I'm being kind of vague, but I want people to read the book and enjoy it the way I have. But I guess kind of what I'm saying is this is the best Venom I've ever read, because to me, Venom was always a cool costume and a cool idea, but
he was nothing without. He was also usually nothing without Spider-Man. Like that's where he was strongest, was when he was used as a foil to Spider-Man.
Yeah, and there was just no depth. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a cool idea on the surface, but the surface was not scratched. I think what Donnie, and due credit to Ryan Segman, whose art is tremendous, what they're doing is they're scratching that surface and saying, all right, here's, if you actually peel back a few layers and try to give Venom some heft, this is what it would look like.
Interesting. Well, I'm going to have to put that on my list. I've, of course, still been working my way, actually very diligently, through our DC Rebirth era challenge.
You don't sleep anymore, right?
Not usually, no. No, I'm about 80 issues from completing the first part of it, which is like 675 issues.
That is insane.
So it's going to take you almost 2 years to get through this first part.
I'll see you when my kid's in college.
two particular ones that I want to talk about. Obviously, you know, we've talked about the virtues of Action Comics and what they've been doing with Superman and his family. Mm-hmm. Many times. There's a particular arc that I can't wait for you to get to in a few years, which kind of harkens back in a way to Superman's black suit, but with Jonathan, his son. So I don't want to spoil anything, but really, really great stuff.
Okay.
But something that I was struggling with, and I don't think that this is the comic's fault. I think it's the way that the reading order suggested it's read. But
I think I know where you're going.
The Wonder Woman stuff.
There it is.
Now, I do think that it was twice monthly, but there's like sort of two... Yeah. Stories going on at the same time. So in the reading list, it has you read the odd numbered issues, then the even numbered issues. So you're reading sort of one coherent one, which the first time that I read it through, that was fine because you could tell how differently the stories were. Mm-hmm. But then the second time they have you do it, I thought maybe this time they should have just probably had you read them all in order, because I read through the first one, everything was fine. Then when I read through the second one, I'm like, okay, hold on, this seems like it's actually filling in pieces of the other one, or maybe this should have came first. And I didn't remember enough about some of the original arcs. So, again, I don't put this on the comic at all and think this was just more a symptom of the way that the reading order had me do it. You know, sometimes you jump back into something and you're like, all right, now where did we leave off? And it's a little bit more complicated with Wonder Woman, though. But I do just like what they're doing with her.
Yeah, just what they did with Wonder Woman. I know that's Greg Rucka's book, and I think it was very ambitious, this whole, we're going to tell a story in the past and a story in the present, and they're going to kind of dovetail, and I love when they do stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, in the defense of our reading list, I think it's hard. There's no real great way to do that. If you were reading the comics as they were coming out monthly, it probably would make sense. But since we have this option, it seems like a good idea to just do all of one story at once. But I think it's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't type of situation.
Yeah, there was also a great moment, and this isn't even just in Wonder Woman. This also extends into the Trinity comic as well. But, oh my gosh, these writers do such an amazing job in so few panels as well, of showing you and just demonstrating the connection and the relationships that Clark, Diana, and Bruce have with one another. You know, there's this great one in particular where, you know, after all the stuff that's happened, Diana's lost her lasso and she's upset, she's angry for various reasons, but both Clark and Bruce can tell. And, you know, when she mentions that a truth has been revealed to her about the gods. And I'm actually surprised they decided to do it this way, where Clark asks which gods, and then Bruce is actually one that stops him and says that's the wrong question to ask, what truth was revealed. And, you know, that has Diana open up more to them. And there's just so much interesting stuff underneath that's going on between these characters that I love to see.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the all-time great dynamics in comics is those three characters, because you have three alpha, incredible, powerful characters who have such different outlooks, and that's why they're such a good team, and that's why they're such good friends, because they balance each other out. And I think this was something that was lost for a few years when Superman didn't really feel like Superman, when Superman was kind of more of seemed like Batman, if it were. I think when you have a Superman who seems like Batman, you don't get the full appreciation. I think you need to have Superman as kind of that paragon of virtue. You need to have Batman as the skeptic, and you need to have Diana as almost the in-between figure. And I think when all three of them are balancing each other out, that's magic.
You know, it's also really interesting, too, when you think about that Trinity, because for DC, that has always been the Trinity. Like, you call them, you know, like these alpha characters, and no matter where you are in DC's history, it's always those three. Whereas on the Marvel side, you know, there are heroes that we draw as, like, parallels and comparisons to them, but Marvel doesn't have, like, those three always at the top. Sure, with the MCU, you know, we think Captain America, we think Iron Man, but when you look through the histories of the comics, like, within the Avengers themselves, they rotate in and out so much. You know, right now it's a lot more of, you know, Captain Marvel, you know, She-Hulk. And it's just really interesting how, again, between the two, DC has these three, you know, concrete figures that never change, and Marvel has more of like a rotating cast at the top.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, too, to think about the fact that, I mean, in some ways, the core trinity of the Avengers for years and years has been Cap, Iron Man, and Thor. But they're the core trinity of the Avengers. They're not the core trinity of the entire Marvel universe, if that makes sense. Because then you're discounting Spider-Man, you're discounting the X-Men, the Fantastic Four. And it's just a cool observation because neither way is wrong, necessarily. But I did always notice that, that there's despite attempts on Marvel's part, they don't have that these are the three most important characters in our entire universe type of thing. And it's been both a detriment and also a good thing at times.
No, I agree. And coming up next, guys, right after this, we're going to be talking about our read-through of In Blackest Night. So stick around.
And I need all of you to stop what you're doing and listen.
Well, we have an unprecedented outbreak.
Thousands of us walking the earth.
We might die at any moment.
Because we're under attack.
In which case, we must act fast.
Doctors are trying their best.
Working long hours and
always sacrificing
their health
to protect you.
Well, I'd very much like to thank them.
Thanks, Doctor.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you, Doctor.
Wait a minute.
What's the prognosis?
It's still changing.
So we have a novel virus and no vaccine at this time.
What should we do?
We gotta get everybody else back into the houses. We gotta keep them there.
In other words,
this is our lockdown, right? What that means is
stay in your homes, make no attempt to reach loved ones,
and take a long nap.
You can count me out.
You can count me out, too.
Some people are immune to good advice.
You know what I mean?
Those idiots.
I just need to make sure you fully understand.
Let's recap.
I'm begging you.
Stay inside.
Wash your hands.
And make sure you've
got 10 feet of personal space around you.
Stay away from me. Stay away from me.
I didn't hear you wash your hands.
So think on this, lads.
When you're home watching TV.
Think about the
medical stuff.
Working for you. So I'm asking you.
Stay home.
I'm in isolation.
To stop the virus.
All right, I'll do it.
Hallelujah.
Hallelujah.
You stay classy, planet Earth.
Welcome back. Thank you for downloading The Other Identity. If you haven't done your due diligence yet this week, make sure you recommend our show to a friend. Maybe listen along with them. You know, discuss some of the opinions that we have. You know, we disagree on occasion. I'm sure that you and your friends will disagree with us as well. So, In Blackest Night, I have been told prior to reading this by a plethora of people that Blackest
Night... Just to jump in real quick, nitpick, the hashtag we used was In Blackest Night, but the story is just Blackest Night.
Yes. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
But I've been told that this is hands down one of the best DC crossover storylines in the history, and I would even go so far as to say that this easily should go into top five crossover events in comics of all time. So I guess my first question is, Ben, why do you think that this works so well? What is essentially just, hey, what if we did a zombie apocalypse story in DC? Why does this work?
I think you honestly nailed it kind of in the question. I think the reason why it works so well is you have two types of kind of event stories in comics. You have the kind of metaphor, allegory, hey, Civil War is really about civil liberties and Watchmen's about, you know, the nature of superheroism, the kind of think piece stories, and those are great. But then you also have the stories that are just, you know what, comics are a heck of a lot of fun, and we should take a simple concept. The simple concept here is, what if all the dead heroes and villains came back, and our heroes had to fight them, and then just make it awesome. Jeff Johns was the mastermind of this. Pete Tomasi was kind of riding shotgun as far as the two writers. Ton of great artists from Doug Monkey to Ivan Rice to Pat Gleason and all points in between. But it's basically just like Geoff Johns is brilliant. Peter Tomasi is brilliant as well. And they knew that this is just a fun concept. That was kind of the heart of the Green Lantern era that this was the capstone of.
Now,
was,
really quick, I just want to get a quick clarification. What Geoff Johns did with the color spectrum, that he had set up a lot of that foundation before Blackest Night. Like, it didn't all come in Blackest Night, right? Okay.
No, basically, if you want to look at Geoff's Green Lantern run, before the New 52, he stuck around for a little while after New 52. But I look at Geoff's Green Lantern run pre-New 52 as there's Green Lantern Rebirth, where Hal Jordan comes back. Then there's a bunch of time spent establishing the different color spectrums in the main book. Then there's Sinestro Corps War, which you should definitely read at some point. That's kind of the halfway point of the run. And then after Sinestro Corps War, more stuff with the colors, all leading to Blackest Night, which is kind of like the big finale. It really is like a trilogy in a lot of ways. Rebirth, Sinestro Corps, and Blackest Night do function as a trilogy with... The only difference between them and like a movie trilogy is that you've also got stuff going on in between. But what I love about all of this is Geoff is the master of saying, this would have been a cool idea when I was 8 years old, and I'm going to do the grown-up version of it. What I mean by that is when we were eight, we would have said, oh, Green Lantern's cool. It would be really cool if there was a Red Lantern. And Geoff says, all right, you know, just because I came up with this idea because when I was eight doesn't mean I can't use it as a professional writer. Because at the heart of the best stories and the best comics are things we would have loved as kids. And that's what I love about his work on Green Lantern, is it taps into the very simple idea of evil twins are cool, different colors are cool, zombies are cool, let's tell a good story with these.
But this is, you know, this is more than just a good story, because obviously Marvel has their zombie dimension as well. And a lot of people love it, but I don't know that anybody's putting the Marvel zombies in like their top five or maybe even top ten, you know, crossovers or stories of all time. Because to me, Blackest Night is actually more than just the zombie version of, of DC, right? And it does come, I think, at its core from the color spectrum and what Geoff Johns set up beforehand. I don't think that in Blackest Night works as well as does without that. Because the one simple thing that I think makes this so great, and what also makes it such an amazing crossover, is the idea that the Black Lanterns have to feed off of emotion, right? That obviously all plays right into everything that Geoff Johns has created up to this point and established for us. But what makes this so amazing for a crossover is that everyone gets to have their own take or their own chance to tell a story, and it doesn't detract from the main story whether you read them or not. There isn't a single comic or a single piece of that crossover that we read that if you took it out would ruin the story in any way. But everyone can do it. Like, if someone's like, no, it doesn't really make sense that Adam Strange is touched by the black. Yes, it does. If he has a loved one that died and he has emotions, it makes sense for everyone. Whether it's The Question, whether it's the Teen Titans, everyone has a story to tell in Blackest Night.
I think what you nailed is that Geoff and the people he worked with basically said, all right, here's the framework. If you want to, and this is how the best crossovers work. It's basically saying, like, here's the conceit. The conceit is dead characters are coming back, and like you said, they're feeding on emotions. So if you want to do a tie-in, if your book makes sense, and like you said, most do, here's the rules. Here's the rules you have to play on, but then you can kind of go off and do your own thing.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about tie-ins here. You don't have to worry about like what I did in War of the Realms when I'm like, okay, so when Enchantress is in Rio de Janeiro and Captain Marvel and Doctor Strange are teaming up to fight her, you know, Captain Marvel was just here in this other issue. How does that make sense? In Blackest Night, it doesn't matter.
No, and I will say also that I gave credit to Geoff for kind of taking like the childlike awesome ideas and making them cool. But the other thing is, it's really smart stuff, right? Like, the emotional spectrum is really well thought through, right? It's not just, oh, we're going to have seven different colors and they have different powers and blah, blah, blah. No, it's like, this hooks into this emotion. This is why rage fuels this. And this is why avarice is important. And as we'll talk more about in our next segment, like, picking different characters and kind of attaching them to the different things. That's, again, that's such a no-brainer that the idea of Flash as a Blue Lantern is cool.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
but the way they execute it is great.
Well, and with that, let's talk about some of our both favorite and least favorite parts. Because first of all,
sure.
When you got the huge splash screens that was all done in black and white, like from the Vision of the Black Lanterns, but mm-hmm. you know the heroes or their victims were like you know bathed in whatever color they were feeling at the time. Those were so great. That was such a unique way of being able to picture some of that, and may have been just all across the entire crossover some of my favorite stuff that I saw. And then obviously, as you know, I pointed out at near the end when the Guardians you know deputized certain heroes and villains to get their own rings, that to me was like that was the high point of the entire arc.
Following up on what I just said and following up on that point, I do want to say, and I said this a bunch as I was doing the read, as I was talking on social media, this is a great Green Lantern story. It's also stealthily an amazing Flash story.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Barry Allen is a star in this story, and it's perfect because he just came back. Like, he's just back from the dead when this story happens. So this is all, like, fresh in his mind, and he's got this great perspective. And I love the scenes with Hal kind of, like, catching him up on all the characters who died and stuff like that. But honestly, you know that over the past few months, it's been kind of a road of me coming to really like Barry Allen.
I'm glad that I was here for it.
You witnessed it, but it was like, I think Blackest Night is the one that pushed me over the edge and said, all right, I get it. And Barry Allen is the avatar of hope, the Blue Lantern color, worked really well. But I just, everything in this story that involved Barry, I loved. I loved him. I liked when Hal disappeared midway through the story and the heroes are kind of like, well, shoot, what do we do? And Barry's like, I got this.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
he just steps up. Yeah.
He steps up, and it's awesome. And I also love to something you've been talking about a lot is I like the use of Wally in this story. Wally shows up in this thing and Barry treats him like a partner. Barry treats him like an equal who can help him as opposed to just like, oh, here, my sidekick's here.
Yeah, let me tell you what to do now.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. The use of Barry and Wally here and kind of them going back and forth, that's what I want from my Flash stories. Mm-hmm. And I thought the way they executed it was great.
So two things that I thought let me down a little bit. And mm-hmm. one of them they could have just completely cut out, and that was the use of one of many of Kyle Rayner's ex-girlfriends.
Oh, my God.
I forget the name of the character now, if you could help me out.
Alex DeWitt.
Yes,
Alex
yes.
DeWitt.
Alex,
yep.
You know, famously being put
into... one of the worst parts of the entire crossover
being
was
put
this.
Into the fridge.
I'm with you.
They brought her back as the fridge. Like the fridge
horrible.
Was wearing the Black Lantern ring. And I thought at this point, like, this was bordering on like horror movie slasher comedy at this point. They could just cut that part out.
There were some books where a lot of these, obviously the comparison here is that this was like a horror movie, right? Because
uh-huh.
of zombies and all that. And there were some books, like particularly the Superman tie-ins that James Robinson did, where I was like, okay, using these guys as like movie monsters and this creepy vibe, mm-hmm. like this is really working. And then there's other ones like the Titans tie-in with Donna Troy's like dead husband.
Yeah, that
kid.
Was another weird
It just
part.
felt gratuitous.
Yeah.
That was where this crossover dipped at times. I think both what you mentioned with Alex, the Donna Troy stuff, anytime they got like gratuitously violent and gross,
mm-hmm.
I wasn't really there for it. Like, I liked when it was a little smarter, a little more nuanced, a little bit more about the emotion and
yes.
the build, as opposed to just, hey, we're cutting someone in half, and this is super gross, and like it's just over the top. That didn't work for
me. Yep. And then the last part that I felt a little let down by, just because the build up, especially through the reading list, was so grand, was Batman's remains. It seemed like, and again, I wasn't super clear on it. Like if he needed Batman's remains in order to change the heroes temporarily at the end, like he did. But then, of course, and I realize it's just a hook for a future story, they also kind of alluded to the fact that, oh, those weren't actually
right.
Batman's remains. So that part of it didn't quite work for me.
I almost feel like it was a neat visual to have Black Lantern Batman, and they wanted to, because Batman had just quote-unquote died in Final Crisis like months before this.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they're probably like, well, if we're doing this whole big story, we need to...
This
is the elephant in the room. We need to address it. But I agree with you. It was kind of a letdown how they ultimately did it.
So that's what we thought about Blackest Night. And coming up here on our last segment is actually something I've been looking forward to doing for a while. And this is actually based on something that you had done a while ago for a blog you used
years
to write.
Ago.
We are going to go ahead and have a quick discussion about who we think would wield each of the power rings from the Marvel Universe, so stick around. That's coming up next.
Students are playing more video games than ever, and that's not a bad thing anymore. With Checkpoint XP on campus, you can peek into the world of college esports and gaming. We talk to personalities in the space like Phasix, who retired from the Overwatch League to join a college team, or thought leaders like James O'Hagan of the Academy of Esports, who's leading the charge on blending education and video games. It's not all black holes and floss dances. Games can lead to college scholarships, and we can tell you where on Checkpoint XP on campus.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to our special Blackest Night episode. We just got done talking about sort of our, I don't really want to call it a review, but it was kind of in a way a review.
A discussion of
one of the greatest DC storylines of all time, Blackest Night.
It's in the conversation, and that's the one thing I will say. Like, we didn't really touch, you said it's considered one of the best DC stories of all time, one of the best events of all time. I don't know that it's the best of all time, but it is definitely in the conversation.
Oh, for sure. I would easily put it in my top five.
I think I'm with you.
And now what we're going to do is something a little bit more fun. This is something I have been slaving over since.
I like this a little bit more fun. Like, the last segment was just work. Like, that wasn't fun at all. That was us just, like, you know.
Well, I mean,
look. Knuckling up and getting it done.
This is all fun for me, but I do think that this sort of discussion is going to be a bit more fun because I think we get to flex a little bit more of our creative muscles. But the idea here is, if the Power Rings existed in the Marvel Universe, who would wield them? And since you showed me your original article for this, I have been slaving over, like, my
perfect just context. Just quick context. Yes, I had a blog with two other guys from Wizard, Ricky Purden, who's now at Marvel, Kyle Fegley, who is actually coincidentally also a professor now. But we worked at Wizard together, and for a little while in the early 2010s, we had a group blog. And one of the things I did during Blackest Night was, I was like, well, what if all these Power Rings went to Marvel characters? And I sent it to you because I knew if anyone would appreciate it, it would be you.
And that basically dominated my entire night for that day, like, when I got that. And then, you know, something that I've been, you know, sort of noodling on since then. So I'm going to go through and give my sort of own list here. And some of the rules that I adhered to was, firstly, I couldn't take anyone that was from your list.
Okay.
I couldn't double up any of the same things. So if you said, you know, Hero A got the blue one, I couldn't choose them for the blue ring.
Okay.
Now, on top of that, I also tried to avoid obvious type answers. Like, you had the Hulk for Red Rage. Of course. Like that
of
makes
course.
Sense. So for the first one, I have, for the Red Ring of Rage, I had Frank Castle, the Punisher.
Ooh, I like that one. Mm-hmm. That's going to look cool, too.
Yeah,
that's a cool visual.
I actually struggled with this one because I really wanted to also give the Punisher the yellow ring of fear. Because I think that, A, you know, something like losing your family is something that a lot of people are feel for of, and then obviously the fear that he strikes into the hearts of basically everyone as well.
But I prefer him with the red ring just because I think the fear thing is... There are other. I'm curious to hear who you have for fear, but I think there's other characters who are more. I like it when it's a more cerebral character. Mm-hmm. Like, I like Scarecrow getting it in Blackest Night. Punisher is just that rage and that need for vengeance fuels him so thoroughly that I think the idea of him as a Red Lantern is much more interesting.
So for fear, and this is one that it took me a while to finally settle in on, and I think what finally swayed me was the depiction of Vincent D'Onofrio and the backstory that was given to him in Netflix's Daredevil, but I went with the Kingpin.
Interesting.
And the reason why is, first of all, you know, given a little bit of the background, again, this is also someone who probably could have been Rage as well, but I think that because of where he is, and despite him always seeming like he's in control, in the comics, what motivates him is trying to find a cure for his wife, who is deathly ill, who he's afraid of losing. He exerts his fear over the city in order to be able to control crime. And I just think that it was a sort of an interesting sort of out of left field kind of application.
I agree. That's not what I would have thought about immediately. I honestly, just because of the Lex Luthor of it all, I probably would have had Kingpin as Orange. But I like this. It's a it's a different way of looking at it, and I think you're right in citing D'Onofrio's version of Kingpin, who really relies on intimidation, as this would be a very good fit.
See, I actually loved probably your original pick for Fear, which was Sabretooth. That was an absolute great one. But the reason that I didn't put Kingpin into Orange, and first of all, your Orange was also a great one, which was Norman Osborn. But I also think that both of those are a little bit too close to...
Luther,
who got it in Blackest Night. I went with Loki for Orange.
Oh, that makes sense.
It really does. Yeah. Like, it goes in there so perfectly. He covets everything that he cannot have. Once I came up with Loki, because I was trying real hard for Orange. Like, some people made sense. And then one day when Loki just popped into my head, I'm like, no contest.
That's it.
Got to be Loki.
Sure.
So for Green and Will, you originally had Hawkeye. Which I get, but I'm sorry, Captain America hands down has to be the Green Lantern. I can do this I can do this all day. That phrase right there to me just encapsulates everything about Hal Jordan, everything about Guy Gardner. Like that is the Green Lantern.
Look, it's the total. It makes sense, but if you're saying that Hulk as the Rage Lantern is too on the nose, I think Steve Rogers as the Willpower Lantern is probably the lowest hanging fruit you can do. It's the right answer, but it's a very... Yeah, I like the Hawkeye answer just because And the same thing, I remember when I did this with DC characters, I liked the idea of using Dick Grayson as the Green Lantern, just because to me it's interesting where, and I guess this applies to Cap as well, but just like when that kind of everyman whose greatest power is his indomitable will. And I think about, you know what, Cap in Infinity Gauntlet, the comic story, when he stands up to Thanos, even though he's non-powered, that is kind of the willpower. Cap also could have been a Blue Lantern, because I do think he represents that hope and that belief that in good. But look, at the end of the day, dude, I'm not going to harp on this pick because it's a great pick. I just think it's the obvious one.
Okay, here's a few not so obvious but really scary ones for you. Magneto or Doctor Doom?
For willpower?
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. That would work 100% because those are the guys who basically are fueled by just persistence and belief in themselves. Mm-hmm. And the other thing you have to remember for the Green Lantern is it's about overcoming great fear, right? So it has to be someone who's somewhat fearless. And I think Captain America works for that.
Mm-hmm.
Doom and Magneto, maybe not as much.
See,
because
Magneto,
I think they're kind of motivated by their fear.
I give you for sure, but Magneto, given his history.
What he survived?
Yes, I think so. Moving on here, though. So for Blue Hope, which you said you had Cap for, I had to go with Daredevil, who could have probably could have fit into a few other ones as well, but his absolute like hard stance line against I will not kill because everyone has the capacity in them to do good, no matter how far gone they are, to come back. I don't think that anyone else embodies will quite as much as that.
There's also the element of with the Blue Lanterns, even though it's not like on the nose spiritual, there is kind of a spiritual feel to them. Like And Daredevil does have that famous like Catholic profile to him, so it fits pretty nicely. And also the costume would look awesome, which is something we should be taking into account. A blue Daredevil costume would
look pretty cool.
Dope.
For purple compassion, I have Miss Marvel, who is someone that I've only just now. I disagree. I think that Violet in Love was actually the hardest one.
Oh really? Okay.
Yep. But for me,
well, there are other reasons that one sets up that you and I have talked about.
Yes. See, and I was actually thinking about putting Miss Marvel here, but because of the way that they normally do the really scantily clad stuff, I just did not feel comfortable with it. But no, Miss Marvel as compassion. I'm not super versed in Miss Marvel's history. I'm still just recently getting into her thanks to Saladin's run of Miss Marvel. But one of the things that always comes back to is how much she cares, not just about herself, but even, you know, there's been a recent issue where her dad is sick. Doctor Strange is doing surgery on her. She needs to be there. But instead of being there, she knows that she has to go and stop a criminal who's out and could end up hurting people, right? And I know that that kind of fits into a lot of heroes, you know, sort of wagon. But I don't know. There's just something about Ms. Marvel as a young hero that no matter what, she's always trying to take other people's feelings into consideration. And I couldn't not put her on here somewhere.
I think that totally makes sense. I'm more, when I said compassion is the tough one for me, is less, like, I understand, like, Ms. Marvel's a compassionate character, it makes sense. It was more that I feel like if we're looking at Blackest Night, the Indigo tribe is just, like, the least defined.
Uh-huh.
So that's why I had trouble with it, because I don't,
okay.
like when they make the Atom the Indigo guy in Blackest Night, it's fun, yeah. But I don't know why he is.
Yeah, you know, it's not the same like when you see Flash become, you know, Hope, and you're like, yeah, let's go.
That makes sense. Let's do it. Yeah, when it's like when someone becomes an Indigo leader, it's like you have the potential for great compassion. It's not really the fist pumping mm-hmm. awesome moment of, yeah, exactly, yep. of Flash becoming a Blue Lantern.
So this last one is probably this character who I really wanted to use was the one that I had the most trouble with, because I thought, okay. you know what, she would fit well into Rage because of the way that she's normally portrayed. She mm-hmm. would probably fit well into Fear just because of some of the stuff that she's gone through. But because of the depictions of Jessica Jones, thanks to Kelly Thompson in Blindside and Purple Daughter, and the way that she writes about how Jessica feels about Luke Cage and her daughter Danielle, I put Jessica Jones as my Violet Lantern of love.
Wow, that's an interesting one, because when you think of Jessica Jones, you typically think of, like, she's a badass, mm-hmm. she's a hard ass. You don't think of, like, love, but yeah, she's really, everything she does is motivated by love for her family, which is a different approach than necessarily just, like, looking at some of the characters who become Star Sapphires in DC, and it's mm-hmm. just like, well, they're really...
Plus,
they have that romantic love. This is more of a familial love, which I really like.
Plus, tell me that it wouldn't be hilarious to see Jessica's response to whatever the ring puts her in.
Hysterical.
That would be, great.
So, and let me say this also, they've sent, for all that I crap on the new 52, one of the things I think they did a good job in is they streamlined that awful, awful costume.
That's good.
It made it a little bit better. So
now I did as far to to choose both a White Lantern and who I think would be the best sort of main head Black Lantern. So the White Lantern, again, someone else who could easily fit into literally every single one of these categories. I would go with Peter Parker for my White Lantern.
Yep. Could have predicted that yep. one, and it's the right.
Let's see if you can predict my Black Lantern of Death, though.
Okay. So you want me to try to predict it?
Go ahead.
Give me a hint. Give me one hint first.
The hint I want to give you might be too easy. Well, I got you. No, I got you. Snap.
Okay. Thanos.
See, now Thanos would be the easy go-to. He has this obsession with death. He loves death. And I think that if you were probably doing a story, he might be a decent one to go to. But no, because of the symmetry that it would create with my White Lantern, Peter Parker, my first Lantern, Black Lantern of Death, would actually be Gwen Stacy.
Oh, okay. Oh, I get the snap.
Yep.
Very nice.
Yes.
Very nasty.
Uh-huh. But the reason why is I think that Necron in the Marvel Universe, bringing Gwen Stacy back, you know, one of the most famous and earliest deaths in you know, the Marvel Universe, you know, she missed out on what should have been a happy life, you know, killed in some people's eyes by the, you know, the guy who loved her. And, you know, seeing Mary Jane basically get to live out the life that she should have had, I think they could have brought her back with a very sort of jealous, you know, sort of rage sort of vision of just wanting to consume the universe, basically. And then obviously you can bring on people like Thanos. Galactus could take on the part of the Anti-Monitor in the Black Lantern battery.
See, my only quibble with Gwen Stacy as a Black Lantern, I think she's a good Black Lantern for, like, a Spider-Man story, obviously, but she doesn't really have any ties to anyone else, and to make her, like, your main, like, her, I'm assuming she would be your Black Hand, like, Black Hand equivalent, I think somebody like the original Captain Marvel, the guy who died of cancer.
A bad one, sure.
Who has ties to Carol, to the Avengers, to all these different characters. Him being kind of like the linchpin of...
Black Hand have a bunch of ties to other people within...
No. I'll give you that. Black Lantern was primarily a Green Lantern character, but I don't know. I just like... I don't think, like, if Iron Man sees Black Lantern Gwen Stacy, I don't think he's affected by it.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
And I think it would be cool for, like, to have a character. And look, if I have one quibble with Blackest Night, and anyone who's followed me knows this, it's that I thought Necron was too much of a cookie cutter villain, and
yeah,
I thought Black Hand
sure.
was much more interesting. And I like the idea of Gwen Stacy, but again, I think it's great. I think you use Gwen Stacy for your Blackest Night Spider-Man limited series.
Mm-hmm.
I think you
because the reason why I went with Gwen Stacy instead of just being like, well, he'd be great for Spider-Man, mm-hmm. is Uncle Ben is
right.
who you would use for Spider-Man.
You use both.
Use both, of course.
Use both. But yeah, yeah. Yep. Good picks all around.
Yep. All right. Well, this ran a little bit longer
than
normal.
Sorry,
you got
guys.
About an extra 7 seconds there. But we want to know who your picks for the Marvel Lanterns would be. All the colors of the rainbow. Let us know at Checkpoint XP on Twitter and Facebook. You can also tweet directly at me and Ben at Robbie_LandisCP and Ben JMORSE. That's going to be it for us today, guys. And something else I need to remind you, that if your favorite local radio station isn't running the Checkpoint XP national show, you can get it on demand wherever you find your podcast. So until next time, guys, remember, catch the other identity right here next week. Same other identity time, same other identity channel.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking 5 of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on 5 we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top 5? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.